You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. And I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as I bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today is Jake Decker, author of One Kid at a Time, the story of a single dad, a boy in foster care, and an adoption. Now, Jake has spent more than 2 years representing children as a court-appointed special advocate, and for those of you that aren't aware of that, we call them CASA. He regularly advocates for child welfare and foster care reform, and currently is working on his next book about children in the child welfare system. I want to also add that to protect his son's privacy, Jake Decker is a pseudonym, as are some of the names that you will find in the book. He's changed some of that, which I think is actually very nice, because when we're dealing with young people and we're telling their story, we don't really know exactly how they're going to feel about that story being told once they become an adult. So I thought that was a very good idea. Now, I want to start out just by giving a statistic that is in the book. More than 100,000 American children are in need of a forever home. Less that one, which is 10-year-old Danny, for whom our guest rescued from his nightmare of foster care. So I want to welcome Jake Decker. Jake,
thank you, Alan. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And one of the things that I saw right away, for anybody out there that has learned anything about the foster care system or even thinks about the foster care system, I liked where you referred to it as a forever home, rather than a quote temporary home. So where does the phrase forever home come from?
Well, it's a phrase that I've heard a lot with child welfare workers. I think it's indicative of their hope that a child finds a permanent, loving place they can call home that kind of transcends all the transitions from place to place that most of them have endured. I think it's an unusual expression, I guess, but it's common within the system, and it's sort of the goal. It's sort of the ideal. It's kind of like living happily ever after, and of course, we know happily ever after does lead to real life afterwards, but the idea of something permanent and permanency is, I think, where that originates, and it's a really important concept because that's what these kids really, really need and want.
Well, and again, I was very fortunate that I got a chance to read the book. So I think what I'd like to do is to go kind of right into that part of the book, because the book really does tell it tells a story, and as I said right from the beginning, of a single dad, a boy in foster care, and an adoption. And I think for those that aren't aware of the system, I think one of the things you'd find is that it's not quite as simple as some of us may think. So share with us a little bit about, your story and how you found yourself in a position, as a single dad deciding that it was time for you to adopt someone.
Well, I think like many people who end up adopting, I had spent a large part of my life hoping and anticipating being a parent. And initially, I started that journey with my partner at the time, and we were going to adopt an infant, like most folks. We thought, start with an infant. That's what you do. We weren't able to have kids of our own, so we decided to have an infant. And that was quite a journey, too. I mean, people that have gone through adoption, there's many agencies and lots to go through. And ultimately, the relationship ended, and through a long series of events, which I talk about in One Kid at a Time, I kept hearing about this kid. The short version is, a friend of mine who was a family dependency law attorney was the court-assigned lawyer for Danny's father. And she said, hey, I know you wanted an infant, but I've got this 10-year-old, and, you know, he's a great kid. He likes to lie, and he steals, and he's got a list of diagnosed psychological disorders, but at heart, he's a good kid. And my initial reaction was, why on earth would I consider that? So, but what happened is that it kept coming up. You know, sometimes I think in life, Alan, our head tells us, I can't do this. This is impossible. It doesn't make any sense. I just turned 50 about a month ago, but never in my life have I had more clarity from a heart place or a soul place or an inner place that this was the right path for me. Now, that didn't happen overnight, but as I kept showing up, paying attention, I kept noticing, I mean, this kid kept coming up, and I was really afraid of meeting him, and I thought, you know, that a child this damaged with this many problems with all the issues he had would not be a good fit for me, and it has turned out to be. I mean, this is not just my legal child. Danny's truly the child of my heart. I mean, I can't imagine loving and feeling about any child any more strongly than I do about Danny now.
Now, if you're okay with sharing, if you could share a little bit about what Danny went through prior to your getting involved, because I think one of the things that captured me in reading the book was the fact that by understanding what his backstory was, that all of a sudden when when somebody is told, like you were told, well, you know, he lies and he steals and he cheats and he gets in fights and he gets kicked out of school and all of these things, I mean, the initial reaction is just, whoa!
Exactly. It's really intimidating.
Yeah. And then thinking, well, you know, wow, that's, you know, that's probably some kind of psychological thing that, you know, that I can't deal with or that can't be dealt with. And I think if you can share a little bit about the backstory, that as I read that, what I realized as I was reading that was, this is someone who went through, you know, a very, very difficult time because of the people he was put around before he found a loving parent to be able to show him what love is really about. And that's what I got from the book was, you know, here, you know, any of us could have been born into this situation and then, you know, had to do some of the things that he did to survive. But, you know, once he was provided a loving situation, not like immediately, but I'm saying, you know, that, so anyway, if you can share a little bit about that backstory, because that I think will tell a lot of people out there, you know, there is a great opportunity for everybody if we give them the right family situation.
Sure. I talk about the first chapter, One Kid at a Time, is sort of Danny's story up until the point we met. But he was born to a young developmentally disabled woman who did not have any parenting skills. During the pregnancy, social workers found her living in an empty storage container, the type that you see on the back of trucks and like an abandoned facility or warehouse or something. And they finally got her into some housing, and shortly after he was born, she returned to addictions and wasn't really willing to take care of him. She dropped him off at her mother's. Her mother lived in the difficult part of the inner city of Tacoma, known for gangs, violence, the sounds of bullets at night were not uncommon. The backyard had broken glass and rusted things and windows knocked out and too many people, too many kids, and no one really paying attention. There was no hot water. They had seven or eight people living in this house, and cold water only. So you know, bathing and things were difficult. There were, I want to say, 30 or 40 referrals to state agencies during the few years he was there. Then his birth father, who was in prison, appeared and wanted to assert his rights, and so Danny went to his paternal grandmother, and while she initially seemed a better fit, it turned out she was much worse. She'd had numerous charges of child abuse, and ultimately he was removed from her home when she'd abused him so badly that the doctors in the ER could not count the number of bruises. He had a chipped tooth, a quarter-sized chunk missing from his hair, and she'd drug him along the sidewalk. So, you know, he just went through a literal hell. You know, it was really bad. And then he went back to the first grandma's because the social workers, again, didn't quite know what to do, and I know how nonsensical that sounds. And because there was a registered sex offender living there, they ultimately put him into foster care when he was 7, and he arrived in foster care, a reasonably cute 7-year-old with a lot of anger and a lot of trauma, a lot of bad experience, and proceeded to act out in foster care. You know, and when I first heard about him, he'd been suspended 9 times in 4th grade and permanently banned from the school bus for assaulting a kid. And yet the more I got to know him, as you said, Alan, the more I believe, I think he might have behaved better than I would in these circumstances. He's a very compassionate, forgiving kid. You know, when I first had him, he wouldn't bathe. And, you know, come on, I don't want a kid that smells bad. I wanted the kid to bathe. And he wouldn't bathe. And, you know, and I was angry. And, I felt kind of my father in there, like, you got to bathe. And I remember, you know, grabbing his shoulders, got to hold him in the shower, and he's panicking. But because I had really taken the time to study his case history, to look at the notes from a social worker, I discovered that when he was 3 or 4, he'd been severely abused with hoses. They would spray him in the face. And all of a sudden, I got why he would take baths but wouldn't take showers. Mm-hmm. And it just opened my eyes, and I started to realize that a lot of these behaviors that I saw as a child being defiant or resisting really were rooted in taking care of themselves, that I needed to be open-minded to things I didn't know about him. And as we developed trust and a bond, so many of these things went away. I mean, they really did. They just faded. They faded in time. But I needed to make allowances for the fact that his upbringing bore no resemblance to mine, and I needed to understand that maybe if he went into a panic attack because he saw a spider or somebody got water in his face, that didn't mean he was permanently damaged and unadoptable.
Mm-hmm. Now, and again, you mentioned a little bit about the fact that you started out this journey and you were hoping, you know, for like a surrogate mom so that you would have that biological child. And then you went to, well, maybe we'll just adopt an infant. You know, take us through a little bit about, how your mind changed, other than the fact that you had somebody who kept kind of bringing him forward. You know, you had to at some time sit back and say, why am I being chosen to start with a 10-year-old?
Well, that's a deep question I would enjoy answering around a campfire under the stars. You know, it's one of these things, Alan, that for me, without getting too spiritual about it, just really felt like the right connection for me. I mean, it didn't at first. I had a vision of an infant. But what happened, you know, I write about this in One Kid at a Time. I was at a Katie Lang concert, and she played this song that she did at the Olympics called Hallelujah. And prior to her singing that, I wasn't even sure I was going to meet him. And by the end of that song, I was committed to meeting him. Something happened. Something shifted. And I think for me, sometimes in life, we have these moments where we get a clarity, a sense of an inner wisdom or knowing that this is something we should do. Now, I talked with friends that were therapists and my parents and others to make sure I wasn't totally nuts. And some of them did have some concerns. But I think when those moments happen, we have a choice. We can ignore what we believe and feel, or we can try it and see what happens. And I decided to try it and see what happens. I had no desire for a 10-year-old kid, but what I did see was when I really distilled my desire to be a parent down to its essence, all I wanted to be was a father. Now, mm-hmm. whether that meant to a young child, an older child, maybe, you know, some of the best, quote, parents I know have never had children of their own and sort of parent adults in many ways. And I realized that the goal for me was fatherhood, mentoring, forming permanent connections, creating a bond that transcends many of the relationships we have in life. And once I accepted that, how it turned out wasn't as important to me. And this was such a strong sense, and things just kept showing up. And what happened is I really started to fall in love with this kid. It was strange. I mean, I wanted not to like him on some level because, I mean, I was, you know, I had a nice mid-six-figure income, couple of homes, comfortable life. Why would I want to destroy that with this kid, you know? And, you know, no more cruises and, you know, flights to the Caribbean and all this kind of stuff. And yet, I think one of the turning points for me was I realized at some point that this child needed a parent. He needed a dad. And mm-hmm. I think that any time that we meet someone else's authentic needs and what we sacrifice are our own likes and desires, it's a good trade. And you see, what I gave up were things that I enjoyed, for sure, but they weren't anything that I needed. I mean, this kid really needed it, and I think I needed to be a dad. I mean, I can't even tell you how much I've grown from, in all the ways that I had hoped to grow one day by virtue of these choices.
Well, and again, in reading the book, I know that, you know, I don't want the people out there to think everything has been rosy. You know, I mean, everything
has been
perfect. So share with us. I mean, what have been some of your biggest challenges that you've faced so far, you know, not only in adopting Danny, but, you know, learning to be a father?
Well, for me, the biggest challenge, especially as a single dad, is something that's familiar to most competent parents, which is, kids can be darned annoying. They have constant demands. You're around them all the time, and they take a lot of work to do an effective job. I mean, you're never off. You know, Saturday morning, you'd be in my room at 7 a.m. ready to go, and 10:15 at night, it seemed like he was barely willing to go to sleep some days. So that was a huge challenge for me in finding the ability to adapt to that. But like most new parents, I adjusted. Then in his case, there were all the issues. He was diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, reactive attachment disorder, I mean, and probably some of the disorders I'm forgetting. And so finding competent child professionals was a challenge, and I was real fortunate. I found a great therapist, a great psychiatrist, a great psychologist, and figured out eventually for him it was better to be off meds than on them, and figuring out what I could do to help him calm down and to be able to function in school in a way that didn't get him suspended and function within a family. And those were hard challenges because I didn't know how to do it. In fact, as you know from your work, no one knows exactly. I mean, we have experts and we have experiences, but every kid's a little bit different. And I mean, there wasn't a manual as to how to make him better.
Yep. And you know, when you just mentioned about the part about the meds, how much of that was just the fact that he had love in his life? You know, because I know that there are some places that believe that if there's a problem, here's a new med for it, until they're on some level of cocktail of meds to where you don't really know exactly what's going on. So it sounds like when you mentioned about getting a good psychiatrist, and I work with some very good ones, the ones that get into that situation where the child is already on quite a few meds, I love the fact that they'll want to deal with the child themselves. And once they're in a loving situation, they'll take them off one, or they'll wean them off one, and they'll wean him off another. So it sounds like that's what they did. They weaned them off enough of these meds to realize that the real child, when they're in a loving environment, didn't need all those things to begin with.
Exactly. I think in this case, that's exactly true. And I want to be careful because there are some children that I think really benefit from meds. I'm not always anti-med, and I know you feel the same way.
Right.
However, in this case, That was not the case. He didn't benefit from meds. And just because he was in foster care, there was a great study that the GAO, U.S. General Accounting Office, did about a year ago, and I think 2020 did a special on it. Foster kids are 3 to 4.5 times more likely to be prescribed psychiatric meds than kids who aren't foster care. It's just that simple.
Uh-huh.
So they try to manage their symptoms. So a kid's too active, and Danny would always, under any scale, be an active kid. So he's always going to look like he has ADHD, and he's always moving around. They medicate him. And while I'm sympathetic to the system, because they don't really have the ability, the child welfare system, to do all the work that needs to be done, the symptom management through medication really irks me, because nothing's getting fixed. At best, you're masking some severe underlying problems, and he didn't need them. And in his case, I think the reason he was suspended 9 times in 4th grade and got so aggressive is the stimulant medications for the ADHD just kind of put him over the edge in terms of his aggression in his particular case.
All right. Well, now, looking at the other side of it, share with us what have been the biggest rewards.
Oh, I think when he just comes and lays down next to me and goes, "You're the best dad in the world," and means it. I mean, he's 15 now, and he still occasionally does that. Now, you know, last thing in the world I did at 15 was tell my dad he was the best dad in the world with my arm around him. You know, so I still get that. It was so obvious that he, you know, what I loved about him is he was all in. He burned his bridges. When he decided that this was it, that this was his only shot, I don't know what would have happened if I would have let him come to live with me and chosen not to adopt him. And that was a possibility. When I chose to let him come into my home, he had to live there a minimum of six months before they can consider adoption. And I was willing to do that, knowing that I had, if I couldn't do it, I could say no. I mean, because I had no sense that I was going to be successful. I hoped, but I didn't know. And so I told myself that I will try this. I will do my best. And if it turns out I can't do it, at least I tried. And so, but I remember a few times thinking, no matter what I choose, this kid is going to be devastated, because in his case, I mean, I was dad the moment he met me. A lot of adoptive parents, it's a big deal when the child first acknowledges you as a parent. It's a special moment. For me, it was there from the beginning. It was like a bad date where the girl you're with says, "Hey, let's get married," and you're wondering what time you get to take her home, you know? It was really not comfortable. And, you know, I think the other thing is the best moments, Alan, they're kind of like quiet moments. We're like out in the boat getting crab, or he got his learner's permit a few weeks ago, so that's been kind of stressful for both of us. I took him on the freeway the first time. I know you don't think of him that way because you read about him as 10, but just watching him grow, and I've stayed in close touch with some of his social workers and his CASA, and I send them photos and let him know how he's doing, because I know that it's often it doesn't work out this well, and when it does, they often don't hear about it, and I love hearing back from them, because it touches them, you know, to see how well he's doing. And, you know, since he's lived with me, another best moment is he hasn't been suspended. You know, I think he's had S, but not by the end of the semester. So I think he's actually managed to pass all his classes, and he's, you know, functioning like a, you know, relatively normal kid.
And, you know, it sounds like when you mentioned the part about, which I loved, you know, the bad date, you know, of, you know, comparing it to the girl that goes, "Okay, this is perfect, let's go get married," but you know, it may be that he saw something sooner than you did. You know, I mean, that's the thought that comes to mind to me, is that, you know, you hadn't lived his life up to that point. He had lived his life, and he may have seen something so quickly of recognizing this is the moment, this is where I'm supposed to be. And I just think it's beautiful. And when you mentioned about the, as far as being 15 and wanting to, you know, to then kind of snuggle up and say you're the best dad, I know right now there's a whole bunch of parents out there listening. They go, "I wish I could get my 15-year-old to still do that." I know for me, I was a room dad when they were really young, and they thought that was great. And then when it came time to go to middle school, you know, they brought me aside and said, "Dad, when we go to the first day of school, can you not sign up, you you know, and and to be the room dad, you know. So it changes, you know, as they, you know, once they become teenagers, there is that change of, you know, not really looking at things the same way. So I think it's beautiful that, you know, that he is still at that point to where he's really wanting to show the love.
You know, Alan, I've been fortunate to do a lot of interviews and some long ones like this, and no one has ever picked up on that or suggested that, the idea that maybe he recognized it. And as soon as you said it, I just got a little chill down my spine. I think you're right. I think something in him knew, this is it for you. This is your dad. And he was just all in. And I had such respect for that. I do. I'm a business person, too. And whenever somebody gives it their all, and they just give it their all, it seems like, I don't know, it just inspires in me the desire to do that myself. And I have great respect for that. And I really, really respected him for doing that, because he was in. He's like, I'm doing this. You're my dad. We're going to be a family. And many times in that period between when he moved in with me and when the adoption was final, I would talk to him and say, look, you don't have to do this. This is our decision. And being a family is hard. It's hard if I've had you since birth. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a hard time at times with my parents. I had great parents, and I ended up, you know, leaving home and doing drugs and going to a group home, and, you know, my dad was a Stanford grad and a professor, and my mom was a master's teacher, and on, and good people. But I was not an easy child. I said, Danny, this is hard stuff, and I don't want to do it. If you want to do it, I'll do it, but we have to both want to do it. And he says, I want to do it. You know, he was so in. He's like, yeah. He looked at me like, I'm crazy. Why are you asking me this? Of course I want to do it. But I needed to be sure, and I needed him to know that you're not trapped. You're choosing this. We are choosing this. We are choosing to be a family. And I think that has served us both well, because in the days that are kind of hard, you know, we know we chose this. And I think both of us, yeah, I really like what you said, but I think he probably really did feel this was the right thing for him. And maybe through the eyes and the innocence and wisdom of a child, he could see that in a way that me as a, you know, 40-something businessman adult couldn't. It took me a while to get it.
Well, yeah, like I said, I just think it's such a beautiful thing. And we have an email that has come across, and I think this is someone else that I think is, you know, wants to synergize along these lines. This email reads, you have tackled a very heart-wrenching topic. My friends used an organization called Friends of Adoption on the East Coast when they adopted their infant daughter, who is now 16 years old. The group promotes, quote, open adoption so that the kids can know their birth parents and have the opportunity to interact throughout their lives. Last year, Sally, the daughter, wrote an essay on the meaning of family. It brought tears to all of us when we read her summary. It said, I'm one of the luckiest kids I know because I have two great moms who love me.
Hmm.
Wow. You know, I love the success stories. So on that, I want to take a break, but we will be right back. I want everybody to stay with us. We are talking with Jake Decker, author of One Kid at a Time. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back with Answers for the Family. We're talking with Jake Decker. Jake's book is called One Kid at a Time, and it recounts the heartwarming story about a single successful man who has made it a priority to share the challenges we face and difficulties the troubled foster care system places on our nation. Now, Jake, if we can go into a little bit about the system itself, share with us a little bit about the challenges that you had, and then let's go into some of the things that you think we can do to make it a better system.
Well, I know it wasn't the intention of the system, but from my perspective, the child welfare system made it more difficult to adopt than if I'd been working through a private agency. In other words, it just seemed like consistently, because of bad policy, bad law, and poor planning, that the system just isn't focused on what we as taxpayers and citizens want, which is to provide permanent homes for kids. And I really don't personally think it's anybody's fault. I think it's just morphed into this scary system that no one knows how to fix. In my own particular case, there were numerous requirements to be certain places, do certain things that didn't make sense, and people weren't there. The negotiations for adoption support, I write about this in One Kid at a Time for a couple chapters, were bizarre. I learned that, for example, in the foster care system, what I discovered was one of the reasons Danny spent almost 2 years in a really bad foster home that was meant to be like a 0 to 30 day short-term stay. And what happened was, the worse he did, the worse he behaved, the more problems he had in school and elsewhere, the more money the foster parent was paid. And if she was successful in improving his behavior, she got paid less. And I look at things like that, and it doesn't make any sense.
Well, and I'm glad you shared that, because I read that in the book too, and I didn't know that, and it was rather appalling to find out that they have a four-step system, and if they're in really, really bad shape and they're really acting out a lot, you get whatever it was, like 3 or 4 times as much money.
Yeah, I think at that time in 2007 in Washington State, a level 4 child, that it's based on age, let's say it's $1,300 a month, and if they're a level 1, like the easiest kind of kid, it's $500, so it's a big gap.
Yeah, and it just seems so counterproductive. It just doesn't make any sense.
I went through a lot. Now, I've been around a lot of bureaucratic systems, and like all of us, you deal with city hall, or maybe you build a house, a planning department, or if you've been in the military, you've got that, and there's a lot of bureaucratic systems we deal with. This has been far and away the most dysfunctional I have seen, and part of it is, I think there's very little public awareness and transparency, and there's a good reason for that. It's because many of the files are private and confidential, and yes, we want to protect people's privacy, but often there's no way to see how bad things really are. As a CASA, I got to see that because I had my own cases, and unfortunately, I found consistently in my cases and cases with other CASAs that a lot of the stuff that I experienced with Danny was common and all through the system, and so many well-meaning, really competent social workers get really frustrated and burned out because they're frustrated by it too.
Now, do you think that a lot of these problems, or the difficulty that the system seems to be making things, do you think that's one of the reasons why so many people just choose to adopt abroad?
I think, yeah, the adoption abroad often bypasses a lot of the waiting, and it's a more certain thing. I mean, I went through that, and it was around, I think, about a $25,000, wait 2 years, and you're almost guaranteed a child. I even went to the orphanages in Vietnam, and in fact, I was at the orphanage 2 weeks before Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were there. They had their pictures up, because that's where they adopted their baby, and it was an interesting, surreal experience. But ultimately, I kind of felt, and obviously after I met Danny, I wanted to adopt him. And I think it's great that we do some international adoptions, but what people don't know is there's like 100,000 kids or more here that are waiting to be adopted. And most of them are considered special needs, but once they're over the age of 6 years old, by definition, they're considered special needs. And so it doesn't necessarily mean special needs the way many of us would associate, you know, that phrase with a child. And I guess if there's anything I could encourage listeners and other people who want children to consider is open to the possibility that older kids are adoptable, because there's a lot of them here. They need homes. And here's the reality. We're either going to help these children when they're young, give them attachment, give them permanence, mentor them, parent them, or we're going to find them washing up on the shores of our adult prisons. We're going to find them homeless. We're going to find them wreaking havoc in society because no one ever taught them anything different. And it just boggles my mind that there are so many resources. In the United States, we spend $25 billion with a B dollars on the child welfare system. That's a combination of federal and state dollars. A little bit of simple math reveals it's somewhere between $50,000 and $60,000 a child. And yet, every expert across the board agrees the system is completely failing to produce kids that can function independently in society.
Yeah, and I think it was the guest last week that said that there are statistics now that shows that, it's, you know, for every $1, you know, that you can spend on prevention will save us $18 in the future because of the fact, as you said, they're going to end up in prison or within, you know, a psychiatric facility or something like that. You know, so if we can start fixing it early, if we can get to it early, I mean, it's one of the things that when you were saying about the monies that they get, you know, why not set up a system that is just the opposite, you know, to where, you know, for the families that can come in that show that they're loving and they can show improvement in that child's life.
Incentivize them, for sure.
Yeah, that those numbers are going to go up instead of going down.
I know foster parents who would adopt. They would love to adopt. They want to adopt. But here you got a kid that if you adopt him, there's all these potential bills for, there may be residential treatment required, there may be medical concerns, and if you adopt, you lose virtually all those resources. So what you're forced to do is stay a foster parent, not give the child what they need, which is a permanent home, in order to secure the resources you need to meet their needs. It's nuts.
So, I mean, what are some other tips that you would offer people that maybe are wanting to adopt and they want to adopt in America? You know, what are the choices that they have that they may not already be aware of?
Well, I have a lot of links on my website, which is jakedecker.com, D-E-K-K-E-R. There are some great national clearinghouses. Adopt U.S. Kids is great. There are a number of foundations that are doing some great work. Without digging too deep, I mean, there's so many I could mention, I'd almost rather send people to some of these clearinghouses. But in general, each state has people who are tasked with finding permanency for kids. We've had federal legislation that is supposed to be encouraging that. And so there are databases and photos and so forth of children who are legally free, available for adoption, now living in your state. For example, in California, I think there's approximately 2,000 children every day that need an adoptive home. Sorry, there's about 55,000 in foster care. But so on any given day, there are thousands just in California alone. And those statistics are changing all the time. In Washington, there's usually, in my state, home state, there's usually hundreds. I was in Oregon recently, and I think it was around 180 or something. I mean, there's a lot of kids. And if someone's considering being a parent, typically what you need to do is develop a relationship with an adoption social worker, and often there needs to be a home study. But then you can have access to these kids and take a look at it. And for me, it's how I created a family. It wasn't what I thought I was going to do. And it can be intimidating because it feels strange sometimes. You don't get the hand-holding you do with the $25,000 overseas adoption agency. It's a different, you know, social workers typically are overworked. It takes them a while often to respond to phone calls and emails. It can feel uncomfortable, but gosh, I think it's well worth doing, it's well worth considering.
Yeah, and again, for those that didn't catch that, the website is www.jakedecker.com, and Decker is spelled D-E-K-K-E-R. So, and again, as some of you know, you can open up, if you're at home and you're on the internet right now listening, you can open up another screen, you can follow along, you can look at some of the things that he has on the site. Now, the book itself, it's available. Is it available everywhere?
Yeah, it's available in many bookstores, and certainly all the online national retailers carry it. It's available in stock, and if a bookstore doesn't have it, they can certainly order it.
Okay, and then is it available also on the site, on the website?
There's a link there to go to either an online or local bookstore.
Okay. Now, one of the things was that you got into this situation. You've been very, very honest about the difficulties facing adoption and so on. What made you decide, I'm going to write about this?
Well, I think those of us, and I know you're a writer too, but I think those of us that are writers, we do it whether we want to or not. Doesn't mean you always publish it, but you know, I've written before under my other name, and what happened for me, and it's also why I became a CASA, I realized I'd had this experience, and my hope was that other children, older kids, would become adopted and find permanent homes as a result of someone reading this book. And I figured, you know what, if one person reads this book and I look at the hours I put into it, and some kid finds a home because this book gave him just enough inspiration to make the difference, it was well worth it. And you know, and it's far exceeded my expectations. I had an email just yesterday from a book club that finished it, and I get many stories of people that are doing respite care, which is where you take foster kids in for weekends and so forth, or other things, or that have taken children in, that they say at least was in part inspired by this. So that was the motivation, and I wasn't sure about releasing it, but Danny and I talked about it, and he was on board, you know, as long as he cares about other kids that were trapped like he was, and he didn't want, nor did I want, his name attached to it, so we changed the name and moved a few things around, but you know, everything's in it is true, other than we changed a few names to protect his privacy. And I said, well, I can wait till you graduate high school and release it then. He goes, well, no, I think, what if there's somebody, you know, there now? So he was fine. He did make me take out one scene that embarrassed him, so I guess I can't tell you what it was. So he read the book. There was one scene he didn't like, and, you know, so I said, no problem, that's gone, because I really thought, Alan, if in any way this book hurt him, then I failed. There's no point writing it, because my goal is to help him, you know, and that's my first and primary goal.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, I, you know, as I was reading it, I was thinking, you know, of some of the kids that I think could read this and find hope for themselves. You know, in other words, not just the adults and the parents that might read it and say, well, you know, maybe I can, you know, go into the foster care system and successfully adopt somebody. But I also envisioned some of the young people reading it and just thinking, you know what, this young man, you know, came out of this way, I can do it too. So I love that type of thing. When you have a book that can bring hope to people, I think you've done your job.
Well, thanks. And it's funny to say that, because I have heard from a number of kids, and I intentionally did want it to be an easy read that, you know, kind of quick and flows kind of tightly, and kids do like it. I mean, I've had some librarians say, you should have written it young adult.
Well, and we have another email message that is coming across right now that I want to read. I'll just read it. It says, I was adopted when I was 9 years old, having lived in 3 foster homes, 2 of which were emotionally abusive. Apparently, I was really a handful. I did not trust anyone or believe I was worthy to be loved. Thankfully, my parents were very loving, full of humor, and very patient. A pediatrician and the father of 2 beautiful kids, 1 adopted, I am living proof that kids are worth saving. Thank you for your wonderful work. I look forward to reading and sharing your book. Wow.
Wow, that's Thank you if you're listening. Thank you for sending that in.
Yeah, that's see, now I'm getting the horripilations you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So let's share a little bit more again about the book. Go through some of the firsts. I know that one of the things that I liked as I was reading it was you had a lot of firsts. You know, you had, well, this was, a first in dealing with, well, like 4th of July or, a first Christmas. Share with some of the listeners just kind of how this affected you and how it affected Danny.
Well, I think all parents love the first. I suppose that's why, a first step and things like that, or the first tooth, are so significant. And I didn't get a first step or a first tooth, but I did get the last tooth. But I didn't get the first tooth. And so, our firsts were things like the first time kayaking, the first time lighting firecrackers. And I know that's not the safest thing, but this kid had so many other problems, and other people were doing it. I was fine supervising and letting him do some fireworks. The first time going on a boat, the first time having a Christmas. I remember when he unwrapped his presents the first year, he grabbed a towel and put it around the box. I'm like, well, what are you doing? He goes, well, I got to catch the bugs. Because prior to that, when he unwrapped his gifts, there were usually little bugs that came out of the package that reside in homes that are filled with bugs. And things like that were so they touched me so much. A first for me was I got him to do choir, and he wasn't thrilled about it, but I believe that music touches the soul. I wanted him to have some arts in addition to other things at school, and you had to go to choir 45 minutes early one day a week. And I remember when I saw him at the Christmas concert, standing there with these other kids, looking like all the other kids, participating with his fifth grade class and singing. It really moved me. He subsequently has quit choir, and that's okay. But I wanted him to have some of those experiences where he could, turn out for cross country or whatever it was, and have somebody reliably show up and get him there and get him the shoes he needed and sing in the choir and make sure he had the t-shirt. He had to bring $12 to the school to get the t-shirt, so you could all match. And the first time taking him shopping, we didn't think fancy. We just went to a Target or a Kohl's or something, and he thought he was on a spending spree at Bloomingdale's.
Well, and I was going to say, I like the fact about just him trying things, because I think with any child, adopted or not, I mean, if they're not given the opportunity to experience certain things, that may be where they are a genius, and we may not know it until they experience it, and we have to try different things. And I know one of my sons, he tried, every year it was a different sport, and he just kept trying different ones, till he found the one that, it's okay, this is the one. It can be a sport, it can be music, a musical instrument or singing or whatever it is. I think that's great. And then, again, as a parent, it doesn't mean that we have to force them to keep doing the things that they choose not to do, but at least they gave it a shot. So I just think that's great that he is getting all of these opportunities.
No, yeah, you're exactly right. I think I just wanted to give him a chance to try him, and hockey was a great example. We tried it, and after about 6 weeks, he says, I think I'm done.
Well, I'll tell you a quick hockey story. Actually, the roller hockey is one of the sports that my son, as he would change every 6 months with something new, he said, Dad, I got a friend that's doing roller hockey. I want to do roller hockey. And I thought, well, with all the other sports, if it was, basketball or baseball or football or whatever, it's not as expensive, or tennis or whatever. But roller hockey, I went to the place, and by the time I looked at the skates and the uniform and the pads and everything, it was a pretty expensive endeavor. So I thought, I've got an idea. And I took him to
sports authority, and I had them outfit him with everything. They put everything on him, put him on the skates, and I had him hook onto my arm, and we walked up and down the aisles with him on those things, and then went back and sat down and said, here's the schedule. They practice 3 times a week. They play games 2x a week. This is what we're going to do. Now, we're going to make a commitment for a whole season. So if we're going to make a commitment for a whole season, let's do it. And he looked at me and he goes, you know, Dad, I think I'll play soccer again.
That's a great story. I was raised the same. When we started at something, my parents expected us to complete the cycle, and then you could quit.
Yeah. So, well, Jake, this has been so inspiring for me. I hope it's as inspiring as it has been for everybody out there. Thank you so much for writing the book. And again, I think as I mentioned in the very beginning, I know you're working on a new book. I hope that you will come back on. You can tell us about the new book. And another thought that I had, and you might mention it to Danny, that when it comes time to go back on, tell him he's welcome to come on also. Because if he
really
wants to,
yeah, he hasn't ever done that yet, but he might. He's older now. He might be willing to.
So if he is, I just think that it's one of the best stories that any of us as a parent can hear is to hear it right from the child's mouth. So please tell him that he is also welcome anytime.
Thank you. I will do that. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be on your show today. I really appreciate it.
You are very welcome. And for everybody out there listening, again, the book is called One Kid at a Time. It's a single dad, a boy in foster care, and an adoption. I highly recommend it. Check it out. It is heartwarming, and it is inspiring. So again, everybody, thank you for listening, and be back with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.